Thought Bubble Audio.
Look, up in the sky!
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Welcome to Beer with Geeks with Tim and Frank.
Who are you?
I'm Batman.
I am Iron Man.
Your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
My name is Inigo Montoya.
You're a wizard, Harry.
A couple of guys with a couple of beers and a whole lot of pop culture nostalgia.
Make it so, number one.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
Name the dog Indiana.
Life finds a way.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Now sit back and crack open a cold one. Because it's time for Beer with Geeks.
It comes in pints?
Shaken, not stirred.
Great Scott!
I was way off. I knew it started with an S, though.
Hi, and welcome to Beer with Geeks. This is the podcast where two geeks geek out with beer. I'm Frank.
And I'm Andrew.
Yeah! Tim is on assignment, and Andrew, our good friend, has finally joined us. You know, he said, okay, Tim's not here. Cool, I'll hop in. So, hey!
Hi!
Welcome to the show, finally. I feel like we've made many references to you in the past.
Yeah, there's definitely been a couple.
Yeah. I'm glad we finally had a chance to get you on the show. Hopefully first of many times. Hopefully we'll have you on again with Tim at some point in the future. But I'm glad that this finally worked out. You and I have a long history of podcasting that goes back many, many years at this point.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's been... when did that stop? I don't even remember what year it was.
2010? 11? I don't. I think 10. I think we did it from like 08 to 2010. Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, around there.
But yeah, it was ages ago. So it's good to have you, good to be podcasting with you again, buddy.
It's wonderful to be back.
Yes. So I am finishing up a six pack here of Omission gluten-free lager. I really like this stuff. It's new to me, and I've quite been enjoying it. Now I know it's Lent. Did you give up the beer for Lent, or are you enjoying one? What's going on?
I gave up drinking for Lent, so I don't
you
have
did.
Anything. All right.
That's respectable. That's a respectable reason. We'll give you that one.
I'll just have to
have another one for you.
Sounds good.
So I, you know, we were talking about, you know, something that you and I and Tim all share, is our love of Disney, right? Our love of Disney movies. And
yes,
certainly on this show, we've talked many, many times about several Disney movies, but one has sort of slipped through the cracks. That I think you and I are particularly well equipped to talk about, and that is the 1940 film Fantasia.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the less widely known, though it certainly is. You know, it does have its own niche audience,
right?
And it's still, every time I hear 1940, I'm like, oh my God, World War II was still going on when this was made. And it's crazy that, I mean, this beautiful, wonderful, just lovely film was made at the same time that one of the most horrible wars in our history was raging in Europe. And it's just true. I try not to view the film with that in the back of my mind every time, because it's, you know, just, it's weird. But today, earlier, I was watching the film and the date hit me and I was like, oh, wow, that's weird.
I had never really thought about that, to be perfectly honest with you. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I never really thought about it in the context of the war, because it's so, excuse me, so far removed, you know, from the war. You don't really think about it. So you're totally right.
One of the things that makes it actually even more beautiful is that in the middle, and this was in the middle of the war, it's 1940,
right,
that they make something that's so beautiful with music from, you know, the whole history of, you know, Western classical music. And it's phenomenal.
It's definitely something that, you know, you have to have an appreciation for classical music to enjoy this movie. And I think that's why one of the reasons why it does kind of get glossed over. This was Disney's third feature film. And by the way, I'm not reading Wikipedia or anything. I just am a nerd about this movie. it was the third. So you had Snow White, and then I think Pinocchio was next, and then this. So this is only the third, you know, feature animated film put out by Disney. Disney, Walt Disney himself had very, very, you know, specific things that he wanted to get out of this movie, and like a certain kind of type of entertainment he wanted to promote and create with this. He saw it as a new sort of form of entertainment. Like you have movies, you have theater, you have ballet, you have opera, and you have Fantasia. Like it's another genre, another type of entertainment. And he had this idea that there'd be this. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, and it really comes across because, not to get ahead of ourselves here, but like the way it starts, it's this whole new thing. It takes what starts off as like a concert and then bleeds into animation, and the animation is feeding off of the music in a really unique way that hasn't really been done since, except for Fantasia 2000.
That's right.
So it really, he succeeded in that regard where he created a really unique kind of thing. Unfortunately, it was at a rather bad time because they couldn't market it in Europe, and it sort of just fell flat in that it didn't spring forth and create this whole new genre of entertainment. But it certainly is a piece of art. It really is fantastic.
It really is. Yeah. And it was like this whole thing because he wanted to do these like road shows where the film would be brought, you know, it wouldn't be just like in wide release. It would be like a thing that came to your theater in your town, and you'd dress up and you'd get your, you know, you'd have assigned seats like in a theater, and there'd be ushers that Disney would train, you know, in your town to like, he already had the beginnings of like the Disneyland, Disney World ideas of like having very tight control over the whole experience. And he was kind of trying to do that here of like, oh, we'll have ushers that we'll put in our own uniforms and train them in our own way. And you'll be guided to your seat, and there'll be all this whole, you know, package, and there'll be a intermission in the middle of the movie and all this stuff. But do you remember the first time you saw the film?
I do. I was 4 years old. My grandma, who you knew very well, she got me the VHS. And I fell in love with this movie immediately. I was fascinated, and I credit it largely with my love of music.
Really?
And this was extremely formative for me. So we picked a good one. It was ridiculously important to me as a kid. When I was very little, I mean, I would stand in front of the TV and I'd be conducting right there with Leopold Stokowski, just you know, following along, and just I'd be picking out instruments. I'd be like, Mom, did you hear that? I mean, this was a couple of years later. It wasn't quite when I was four, but this is what started. Like, you know, oh, just hear the violins come in here, and oh, those French horns are beautiful. And you know, I'm just picking out instruments, and this was really what drove me. And I mean, still to this day, my favorite Beethoven symphony is the sixth because of Fantasia. And it really was such an important part of who I ended up becoming. I use bits of it in my classes when because I'm a music teacher now. So it really affected who I became.
You know, I didn't realize just how profoundly this movie had impacted you. When I suggested this as a topic, I knew we both liked it, but I didn't realize quite how important it was for you. This is really cool. I'm glad we're talking about this.
That's why I emphatically agreed.
yeah, awesome. I remember seeing it. I think I've mentioned on this show before. I didn't spend a lot of time going to Blockbuster as a kid, but I did have a public library around the corner from where I lived that had an awesome VHS collection. And it had like every Disney movie, you know, all sorts of, there was like an entire giant kids section with all sorts of cartoons and just kids movies and stuff. And I remember, I think my dad was very, is still very, very, has a lot of impact on my musical taste and mm-hmm. taught me a lot about classical music. And that's, he's really, I credit him entirely with my love of classical music.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he took me to the library one day and picked this out and said, oh, hey, you know, we should watch this together. This would be fun to watch. And so that's how it started. And we brought it home and watched it. And yeah, similarly, I was really, really, I was really, really, you know, drawn in by it. Some of the music I already recognized, which helped. I couldn't have been that old. It couldn't have been more than about six when I first saw it. But I was familiar enough with like Toccata and Fugue and D minor and the Nutcracker Suite and things like that that are, you know, super ever present, right? So that drew me in. And then things like The Rite of Spring or Night on Bald Mountain or Dance of the Hours, those things sort of I picked up from this film.
Not a lot of you know, 4 and 6 year olds listening to Stravinsky, so it's
exactly and you know, I didn't love it the first time I heard it either, but it grew on me over time.
The Rite of Spring, as you may remember from our freshman year music class, caused a riot when it was first performed. So
it did. I was just like, cool, dinosaurs. Because I'm six, and that's what you think when you're six. Of course.
I wrote that down in my notes, actually. Dinosaurs! Exclamation point.
Oh, man. Yeah, so that was, like, my first reaction to it the first time. Do you have, like, a favorite... This is hard to pick out, but, like, a favorite sequence, or could you, like, list a couple of your favorites?
Yes. My favorites are... the Pastoral Symphony and the Dance of the Hours. Those are like those stand up as my favorites. When I think of Fantasia, I think of the Pastoral Symphony scene with all of the, you know, the Greek mythology and everything. It's a lot of fun. And the for me, that one, I think most perfectly just captures the feel of the piece. And then the Dance of the Hours is just fun.
It sure is. That's the one with the dancing hippos, for all of you who may not remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I also really, there's something really moving about the animation paired with the Waltz of the Flowers from the Nutcracker Suite, where it's the seasons changing and the... you know, so you've got those like fairies like making fall happen, and then it transitions into winter, and it's beautiful with the animation and the music. The music's, I mean, it's Tchaikovsky, it's beautiful anyway, but there's just something about the French horns right at the beginning of that, where you just hear it, just it feels so perfectly matched with the animation. And of course, it's, you know, it's from the Nutcracker, it has nothing to do with that at all, but it just that for some reason, despite not having to do with it initially, it feels like autumn. You can get that autumnal feel from the animation, and it just, it really, the French horns make it, and it fits perfectly, and I get chills when I see that. It's just absolutely,
it's so good. I typically save the Nutcracker Suite to listen to, you know, before Christmas, like around Christmas time. With, I have a ton of Christmas music that I kind of put into cold storage 11 months out of the year. And then from like Thanksgiving to Christmas, it's just no holds barred. I play it like nonstop.
You and me both.
This has just been a thing my entire life. And the Nutcracker is part of that. You know, while it's not, you know, it is... The ballet, right, takes place at Christmas and everything, so it feels appropriate to save for that. Really, I feel like I could listen to it any time of year, but I typically save it for then. And whenever I do, whenever I bring it out, these very vivid images pop into my head, and the images are the ways that the different pieces are animated in Fantasia. You know, that's what I picture. Especially like Dance of the Flutes and like the Chinese dance and the Russian dance, like those specific ones for some reason come to mind when I listen to those pieces. I can visually picture the little like mushroom guys or whatever they are.
Oh yeah, absolutely. To the point where I did see the ballet and it almost was confusing because I'm like, well, but the choreography is so different from the,
where are the mushrooms?
From the mushrooms and those dancing flowers. And, yeah, no, but it's really, it was very well done. I mean, the whole thing was
very well done. Yeah. Yeah. Beautifully done. I've really like, you mentioned the Pastoral Symphony. That's one that, so you said that that's like the first thing you think of when you think Fantasia. That's mm-hmm. not for me, interestingly. Mm-hmm. It kind of actually probably falls lower on the list, maybe because when I was a kid that like didn't understand that as much. So I may have skipped it a couple times when I was a kid.
Sure.
So it's not the first thing that comes to my mind. What is it that you love about that you know, section so much? I mean, the music, obviously, the Beethoven is beautiful, and the animation is beautiful, and the, you know, the all the centaurs and all that stuff.
I mean, I think just the whimsy of the animation, coupled with the whimsy in most of the music, and then what was really I don't know, it sticks with me. And then there's the movement that they turn into, that that wonderful thunderstorm with the wind and the rain and Zeus throwing down lightning bolts, and it fits the music so perfectly that I just keep going back to it in my mind, and it's incredible.
So good. So I mean, like, it's beautiful. You're right. It is beautifully like paired together, and the sort mm-hmm. of, you know, no pun intended, sort of the Mickey Mousing of the, you know, of Zeus throwing the lightning bolts, and the perfect matching up of that with the music. I mean, it really, throughout the whole film, but like that's a really good example of where it feels like the score mm-hmm. was written for the movie and not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I don't know. There's just, and then the finale is just of the symphony.
Oh man,
it's majestic. That's just as much credit to Beethoven as to the Disney animators. It's majestic. That's the word for it. And then of course, I don't know. It's just the whole thing's really just a lot of fun. And then the finale of the whole film, of course, it doubles down on that majestic feel with just that serenity at the end of the film.
With the Ave Maria and like the like monks, mm-hmm. that with the torches and everything, that, you know, thinking about what you said a few minutes ago about the context of the war, like that actually just took mm-hmm. on a whole new meaning for me, because mm-hmm. like, think about like this sort of, you know, like it's a very troubled time. One of the most troubled, if not the most troubled time in American history, or in world history, really.
Yeah.
And here's this sort of serene, calming, you know, beautiful scene to go with this, you know, religious piece of music. I mean, I'm sure it was a very, very impactful and like uplifting thing for people.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of a really terrible war. I mean, I guess this is before the U.S. entered the war, but the road shows would mm-hmm. have gone on from 40 into 41.
Yeah.
So it may have been.
Yeah, it's especially that way. You know, that sort of calming and hopeful message at the end, especially when you consider that the piece before it is Night on Bald Mountain.
That's right. Yeah. So you have like the high and the low.
Exactly. So you've got Night on Bald Mountain, which is, again, a phenomenal piece of music. And you've got all of this imagery, this darkness. You've got the Chernobog and ghosts and demons, and they're terrorizing this town. And then the Angelus bells ring, and they all go back to, you know, their slumber, back to their graves, and then the Ave Maria comes in. So it's as if to say all of this darkness will pass. And of course it did.
Right.
But it's when looking at it in light of when the film came out, I think that just adds so much more depth to those final two scenes from the film.
Totally. Totally. I totally agree. I totally agree. Yeah, I had never thought about it in that context until today. So you just totally made. I'm gonna need to rewatch soon with that in mind and kind of and really really soak that in. I feel like that at the very very end and up at the very beginning, Toccata and Fugue. That has always if I could just watch like one sequence from the film, it would actually be the Toccata and Fugue sequence, because I love the way that it takes you, and I think you made mention of this earlier, it takes you from sort of the live action, the shots of the orchestra, right, and seeing all these colored mm-hmm. lights on the different instruments, and it just sort of gradually takes you out of reality into this sort of, you know, in between real and not real, in between real and animated, and then takes you fully into this abstract, you know, completely animated environment that is mm-hmm. reflective of what you're hearing.
Oh, yeah. And like, don't get me wrong. When I say that the other two were, you know, were my favorite or come immediately to mind, it's not a very strong lead. the whole thing's pretty incredible, but then this sequence, the Toccata and Fugue, would be where I would be in front of the TV conducting. So this was also an incredibly uh-huh. important thing for me. And I mean, you've got that again, the sequence at the beginning of it, the Toccata, you see all of the instruments. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's some highlighting or interesting lighting and some very interesting camera effects that they did. So you've got different sections overlaid over each other, but it's mm-hmm. just the performers and their instruments, but it really highlights them very well. And it helped me really get to know the instruments of the orchestra from a very early age.
Same.
And so that I'd be like, oh, wow. It made the harp look like a phenomenal instrument to play. I'm like, oh, I want to play the harp. Never did, unfortunately. But, and I'd say, oh, wow, the French horns, those are pretty cool. And, and the timpani, because you get that, playing that nice, those nice bass notes there for, that one section of the Toccata. And they hit a light on each timpani drum as he was playing it. And it's just cool. There's something really fun about it.
Yeah, exactly. Those images are very, very strong in my mind, mm-hmm. too. And
I'm sorry, we start talking over each other because we're so excited about it.
And then as you go into that sort of abstract, that abstract animated section of it, it's so gradual and it's so, I don't know, there's something about it that is really, really is like entrancing to me. And I like I said, that's one section that I could just rewatch. Just that section, you know, like in a pinch, and be really happy with that, because I love it so much and I find it so calming. It's something that I could almost mm-hmm. watch before I go to sleep, not because it's boring, but because it's so soothing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And what's fascinating to me about how they did it is, like, you know, so it sort of transitions so that the Toccata ends and they go into the Fugue and sort of color just takes over, and then you can still see like forms of instruments. So like the beginning, you can see, you know, violin bows play, you know, moving up and down, and that's what's, you know, representing the violins playing that, you know, very famous opening sequence of the Fugue. And then everything just starts getting more and more abstract as you go, and, you know, you can see every now and then there'll be like either shadows or colored lines in groups of four, which are okay, so that's the string section coming in. But and that's sort of a motif that goes on throughout the whole thing. You can see things representing the strings, but everything else just becomes completely abstract. Even those are abstract, but you can still see where the representation is, you know, what it's representing. If you're thinking about it, but usually I don't think about it too much when I'm watching it because it's just so beautiful.
You know, something that is also worth mentioning is, like, this is all really like trippy sort of looking stuff as you're watching it, and especially I think in 1940 it would have looked really trippy and you know mm-hmm. out there. And then add to it that this is the first time that many people are seeing a movie that has the sound in stereo, and it's coming at you from both sides, you know, like that was a new thing. That was so you're really tripping out, because like there's all these weird images that are so abstract and so and beautiful, and then the sound is coming at you from your left and your right, and you hear the mm-hmm. instruments, you know, and it probably sounds very much like you're actually there. It's a really, really interesting experience if you put yourself in that 1940s audience.
Yeah, and I mean, I was reading about it earlier a bit to refresh myself on some of the behind the scenes stuff, and they had to, whenever they brought it to a theater, they had to bring and install special equipment to play the sound. So it's a whole ordeal. That's why they lost a lot of money. That's part of why they lost money on it initially.
Right.
Why it wasn't, you know, I mean, it has since done somewhat well, but it, you know, that's a lot of commitment to this, and it's phenomenal, and it really creates such a beautiful effect. And another thing that struck me today in my rewatching of, you know, parts of it, I rewatched this entire sequence, of course, was some of the animation almost looks like it was done with computers, but of course that's impossible because it was made in 1940. There's one bit right in the early part of the fugue where you can see the strings and bridge of various string instruments flying by, and they almost look computer generated unless you look closely because they're spinning, so it looks like a 3D effect.
Huh.
But that was hand drawn because, right, again, it was 1940. So, I mean, that just speaks so much to the incredible talent of the Disney animators that it's just, I mean, it, again, if you were to show that to someone today, they'd be like, oh yeah, they'd think that it was done with computers because it looked computer generated. But it was hand done, which is mind blowing. It's absolutely ridiculous.
It's amazing. I mean, and yeah, I mean, you can't give too much credit to those animators because they were, I mean, drawing all this stuff by hand and just creating these incredible images. But they were really at this time, you know, in the late 30s and early 40s, really like advancing the art of the cartoon and of animation and sort of making it more and more photorealistic and turning it from like comic strip Popeye type of thing into this art form. I think we only have a few minutes left, I think we can't let this conversation end without talking about the Sorcerer's Apprentice, though.
Absolutely. This is actually where it started.
That's right. Because they wanted to make a short, and then it went over budget, and they said, well, let's make a whole movie. Like, they had these other, Walt had other ideas, and so they built a movie around it.
And I mean, of course, this is, again, right up there with, you know, the iconic scenes. And in fact, this is probably, in terms of the general population, what people know from Fantasia, even if they don't realize that it's from this, because
that's probably true.
This has become the like branding of Mickey Mouse. And I mean, you see at Hollywood Studios down in Florida for a while, they had I don't know if they still have it, but they had the giant hat from the sequence.
Yep.
I think they still do.
When I was there last year, I don't think it was there anymore.
Oh, they might have gotten rid of it. I haven't been down there since 10 years ago.
Oh, geez, yeah. It's come and gone. But this was also like the reintroduction of Mickey Mouse. Like this was the first time this look for Mickey was debuted, because before he had more of like that Steamboat Willie type of look. And this was the first time that sort of the modern look of Mickey Mouse was shown. This is the new, you know, his new face. So it was kind of a big deal. You know, if you were a fan of that character, it was a big deal in that character's history too.
Oh, sure. And now, do you remember, this is another, like, you know, we're from when we are kind of thing, but do you remember on a lot of the older VHSs that, one of the series of old Disney sort of title cards would have been Mickey with the Sorcerer's Apprentice get up, you know, the robe and the hat, and then, you know, he'd do a little bit of magic, and then the Disney logo would appear writing out Walt Disney's signature and everything. And that was iconic. That was how every Disney movie started for a long time.
Yeah, and I guess you know, thinking about it, I guess they don't use that image quite as much as they used to, but it's still in my mind, it's still sort of like the almost the company's logo, you know, like it really obviously everyone knows that image super well, like you said, even if they don't know it came from this movie, but like it is sort of the canonical look for Mickey. If you were going to draw, like, just like if someone just said draw Mickey Mouse, they'd either draw him with like the suspenders or they'd draw him in this getup.
Yeah. And then like it sort of entered into the parks when they created the Fantasmic show.
That's right.
He wore the outfit during that show because he's doing, you know, all sorts of pyrotechnic magic and everything. So it really has sort of in recent years, it's more subtle and it's less, you know, less used, unfortunately, but it was a staple image of Mickey for a long time. Mm-hmm. since 1940.
Exactly. Yeah. Like we said, it still is sort of like a, maybe not as big a logo, like sort of like a main image of the company as it used to be, but it still is like one of the most recognizable images, you know, anywhere in the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about whimsy, right? Like this sequence really has a lot of whimsy and is very fun. Mm-hmm. And you know, sort of teaches a little lesson to kids, you know, that kind of thing. But it's really I don't know. It's a lot of fun. It's a fun sequence. It's the one sequence that they saw fit to put into Fantasia 2000 as well.
Yes, and that was a really nice touch.
Yeah,
to sort of.
You can't have Fantasia without that sequence.
Now, a little bit of trivia about this sequence: the wizard, or sorcerer, I should say, the sorcerer has a name. Did you know what it is?
I don't remember what it is.
It was never said in the film or mentioned in the film. And of course he doesn't say anything, so it's sure. Not credited or anything, but, the animators referred to him as Yen Sid, which if you're clever, you'll realize is Disney backwards.
That's great. That's really great.
He ended up eventually being a character in the Kingdom Hearts series of video games, and so he's known as Yen Sid. So that name became, you know, came out there as not just the animators who knew it anymore, but I just think that's hilarious.
That is really funny, and that is some really good trivia.
That is some really good trivia.
Yeah. So if you're at a party and you want to pull that one out and impress somebody, there you go, kids. Wow. Well, I think we're just about out of time on this one, but man, we are definitely going to have you back, Andrew, because this, as predicted, this was an absolute blast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, glad to have you as my co-pilot while Tim's off on assignment. But Tim will be back soon. Until then, you can find us on the internet at beerwithgeeks.com, at beerwithgeeks on Twitter, beerwithgeeks@gmail.com. If you have any feedback or topics or anything like that you'd like to share, please leave us reviews on iTunes. Those are super important to us. 5 stars would mean so, so much. So please do that. Be sure to check out the all-new beerwithgeeks.com, where you can find this episode by going to beerwithgeeks.com/149. It's episode 149. You'll find the show notes and everything there. I think about does it for us, right?
Yep.
All right. So until next time,
cheers.